This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, February 21, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. On Capitol Hill, the Supreme Court considers a case that may roll back the Clean Water Act. National civil rights organizations hope a new report will urge Congress to renew the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And the Council of Europe condemns France's human rights record in a 200-page report. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. A Bosnian Serb accused of leading a paramilitary group that killed dozens of Muslims during the Bosnian War has arrived from Argentina at the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. Zoran Čulafić reports from Belgrade.
Bosnian Serb Milan Lukic has been transferred today to the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague. Lukic was arrested last year in Argentina after almost 7 years on the run and is now facing several charges of war crimes. The UN court indictment states that during the 1992-1995 Bosnian War, Lukic led a paramilitary group known as the Avengers or White Eagles, which worked with local police and military units to spread terror. The paramilitaries are blamed for the murders of at least 100 Bosnian Muslims. The UN tribunal charges against Lukic include beatings, mass executions, and barricading groups of Bosnian women and children into houses that were then set in fire, while anyone trying to escape was shot dead. Last year, Lukic was convicted for the murder of 16 Muslims in 1992 and sentenced in absentia by a Belgrade criminal court to 20 years in prison. In that case, Muslim men and women were kidnapped from a bus and their bodies later thrown into a river. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zoran Čulafić in Belgrade.
As we go to air, a number of news outlets are circulating unconfirmed reports that top Serbian war crime suspect Ratko Mladic has been located and arrested. Mladic is wanted for crimes against humanity, including the 1995 Srebrenica massacre. The government of Serbia and Montenegro has denied rumors of the arrest. Egyptian police arrested 15 people today, suspected of participating in sectarian clashes in a village outside Cairo. Ursula Lindsay has the story.
Fighting broke out yesterday between Muslims and Coptic Christians in the village of Al Ayet. 11 people were injured and several buildings set on fire. The violence reportedly erupted when Muslims objected to Christians renovating a building. The Muslims believed the building was being turned into a church. Egyptian law requires special government authorization to build churches. Christians, who make up about 6% of Egypt's population, consider this law discriminatory. The clashes in Al Ayet are just the latest instance of sectarian tension in Egypt. On February 18, sectarian fighting broke out in a village in southern Egypt, where Muslims accused local Christians of burning copies of the Quran. Also last October, Muslims rioted in Alexandria over a play staged in a church that allegedly insulted Islam. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ursula Lindsay in Cairo.
The moderate faction of All Parties Hurriyat Conference, the main alliance of separatist groups in Kashmir, has declined to attend the Kashmir Roundtable Conference, scheduled for this weekend. Shahnawaz Khan reports.
The Roundtable Conference, called by Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, is the first of its kind, in which a cross-section of people from Kashmir, including mainstream as well as the separatist groups, have been invited. The hardline faction of Hurriyat Conference had already declined to attend the Kashmir Roundtable Conference. On Monday, even the moderate faction rejected the invitation. The moderate faction of Hurriyat Conference has been one of the key supporters of the peace process and the first to enter into a dialogue process with India. Announcing the decision, Mirwais Umar Farooq, chairman of the moderate faction, said the time was not yet ripe for such a conference as India has not taken concrete steps to resolve the dispute over Kashmir. The roundtable conference loses much of its importance with the refusal of the both factions of Hurriyat Conference to attend it. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan.
President Bush paid a visit to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Colorado today as part of his cross-country energy tour. However, as Maeve Conran reports from Colorado, the administration's current talk of commitment to renewable energy is out of step with recent budget cuts.
After the State of the Union address, in which President Bush said Americans were addicted to oil, the Bush administration has been touting the benefits of renewable energy. However, Bush's visit today to the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, the premier lab in the US for researching renewable energy technologies, comes just weeks after $28 million was cut from the lab's budget. George Douglas, spokesperson for the NREL.
Well, what the lab did to make up that $28 million was cut money wherever possible, delayed or canceled some subcontracts, that is, contracts with industry and academia outside to do research, and then ended up still with not enough money to keep everyone employed. And so we had to lay off 32 people on February 7th.
The lab announced on Monday that $5 million in funding would be restored by the Department of Energy, which will allow them to reinstate the 32 workers. However, they are still facing a budget deficit of $23 million. For FSRN, this is Maeve Conran in Boulder, Colorado.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Supreme Court has announced it will revisit a partial birth abortions case which involves three federal appeals courts' decisions which ruled that the newly enacted Partial Birth Abortion Act is unconstitutional because it doesn't take the mother's health into account. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously last month that the entire law should not be struck down because one part is problematic. The Bush administration has strongly urged the Supreme Court, with its two new Bush appointees, to take the case up immediately, and the court will hear the case later this year. In other news from the Supreme Court, justices heard two cases today that could roll back the Clean Water Act. As Leanne Caldwell reports, the environmental protections in question could impact a wide range of waterways in the United States.
In both cases, real estate owners want to develop unused land. In both cases, the government says development on these lands could have an adverse impact on waterways. In the first case, Rapanos versus the United States, plaintiff John Rapanos wants to build a shopping center on some wetlands in Michigan. The government says the wetlands are protected because of the possibility of pollution runoff. The Clean Water Act, which passed Congress in 1972, regulates any waterway that has the potential to drain into a navigable body of water. A navigable body of water is what's in question. Does that body of water actually carry ships or boats? Or could that body of water possibly, someday, run into a body of water that does carry ships or boats? This also brings into question how wide is the government scope of regulation. Reed Hopper is the attorney for John Rapanos.
We don't have any navigable waters anywhere near these properties. We have ditches, we have culverts. The federal government overstepped their bounds. The federal government is trying to take over the whole country, and if they do, all of us will lose. We will all lose if the federal government gets away with this.
Hopper continues to say,
the water that comes out of a spigot in your house is regulated. That's exactly their position, that a spigot in your house is a point source and it's regulated. Now, that's insane.
Those ditches and culverts were a centerpiece of questions by Supreme Court justices. They will determine if those ditches are able to be regulated by the federal government. The second case is similar. June Carabel also owns wetlands. They're right next door to the first plaintiff's wetlands, and he wants to build condos. Ditches and culverts were a central point in this argument as well. The difference with his case is slight, but it has to do with hydrologic connection. That is, the actual connection between two water sources. The government says they have the authority to regulate. Timothy Stuker is Carabel's attorney.
Well, that poses the hypothetical that was raised by the court this morning. The rain itself would not necessarily create the discharge that, in fact, leads to the navigable water, as was pointed out in our case. The ditch actually next to the Carabel property is specifically defined not to be a waters of the United States, and therefore it would not be regulated.
This is the first environmental impact case brought before the Supreme Court with two new conservative justices, Chief Justice John Roberts and Associate Justice Samuel Alito Jr. If the court sides with either one of the plaintiffs and says that a provision of the Clean Water Act is unconstitutional, it could reverse environmental policy that the Environmental Protection Agency and the Army Corps of Engineers has been following for 30 years. And that is that all waters within the United States, no matter how remote from a major waterway, is regulated by the government. A broad coalition of environmental groups and former government officials have joined together to say that a ruling that sides with the plaintiffs could be detrimental to environmental progress. Russell Train is former deputy administrator for the EPA under Presidents Nixon and Ford.
The waters of the nation's waters include not only the navigable waters, but the tributary streams and the connecting tributary streams and the adjacent wetlands and connecting wetlands.
Kim Connolly is director of the Environmental Law Clinic at the University of South Carolina. She filed an amicus brief on behalf of members of Congress. She says Congress defined the reach of government regulation 30 years ago.
Congress had a broad intent to protect the nation's waters. And they had protections in mind if you look at the legislative history.
The Supreme Court should hand down its decision later this year. That decision will impact waterways in all 50 states. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
A report detailing the state of minority voters using research and testimonials is set to be released today. National civil rights organizations hope that this report will urge Congress to renew the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which prohibits discrimination in voting practices or procedures because of race, color, or language. Selena Masuta reports from Washington, D.C.
In the upcoming months, Congress will decide whether or not to reauthorize key temporary provisions in the Voting Rights Act that are set to expire in August 2007. These provisions include the requirement of certain jurisdictions, many in the South, to obtain approval from the Department of Justice before they can put into effect any changes in voting practices or procedures, as well as the provision added to the Voting Rights Act in 1975 that requires language translation for people with limited English proficiency. Supporters of the Voting Rights Act, as it currently exists, cite current violations to the Act. Barbara Arnwine of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law points to an increasing number of complaints since 1982 outlining discrimination during election time that make the reauthorization of the act even more necessary.
Was once you had the Voting Rights Act and you had enforcement of that constitutional right, many of those barriers failed. Unfortunately, the commission report shows that it has not stopped jurisdictions from being creative and coming up with contemporary mechanisms of blocking and impairing the ability of minority voters to participate equally in the franchise.
Critics of the reauthorization say that since 1965, the election of officials of color has increased more than 50%. Therefore, these provisions are no longer needed. But Bill Lan-Lanley, chair of the commission that filed the report, disagrees.
It is still today in America, 40 years after the Voting Rights Act, true that it is very difficult for an African American or other minority candidate to be elected for majority white political entity. It's a telling number, that 9,000 African American elected officials, but it's also telling in that it shows how much more we have to go.
President Bush plans to urge Congress to reauthorize the act. Selena Masuda, FSRN in Washington, D.C.
California death row inmate Michael Morales was set to be executed early this morning for a rape and murder conviction dating back to 1983. But legal appeals and debates delayed his execution to 7:30 p.m. Pacific time tonight. FSRN's Christina Anastad has more.
Michael Morales will be the first Mexican-American to die on California's death row since it was reinstated over 30 years ago. Outside the gates of San Quentin, opponents of the death penalty echoed protests to spare Morales' life.
No one or I had the right to kill anybody.
I oppose the death penalty in its entirety. I think it's a tool used exclusively against poor people of color.
80% of the people on death row in California are on death row for killing whites. However, only 26.7% of murder victims in California are white.
I think I'd like to see him maybe spend 30 more years suffering in jail than have the death penalty and get the easy way out.
It has nothing to do about morality. If it was about morality, then the same people that work in the U.S. government have to be executed for what they've been doing all over this planet.
Some anti-death penalty advocates support life without parole. Still others support a more radical overhaul of the prison system and ally themselves with abolitionist movements. There are also those who do not want to see Michael Morales live. George Winchell stood quietly, remembering his slain cousin, Terry Winchell, who was brutally murdered and raped by Morales nearly 25 years ago. Winchell and death penalty supporters say they want justice.
There's really nothing else that can be said. We've been dealing with this for over 20 years. It's time to end it.
Why are you here tonight?
To support my family, because he needs to pay for what he's done. It'd be no different if it was one of my own children. I would stand behind it. That's the way it is.
I think it's wonderful. I think the world is better off.
He should have died 20 years ago. He's guilty as sin. He needs to die for what he did. Of course it's not going to bring her back, but it's going to bring some justice.
After the anesthesiologists refused to participate in the execution, San Quentin's warden announced that they will use a lethal dose of barbiturates to kill Morales at 7:30 p.m. tonight. But that decision may be too late. Judge Jeremy Fogel's initial ruling required the state to give notice last week by Thursday, February 16th, if they were to use barbiturates to execute Morales. It is unclear whether Morales' legal team will challenge his execution on such grounds, leaving everyone in limbo. Reporting for FSRN at the gates of San Quentin Prison, I am Christina Onnestead.
France's human rights record has been condemned in a 200-page report released by the influential Council of Europe. The Council of Europe's Human Rights Commissioner, Alvaro Gil Robles, was particularly shocked by the prison conditions, saying that, except for Moldova, he has not seen worse facilities. His report follows a plea by 10 inmates last month in which the men asked for the reintroduction of the death penalty for themselves in an expression of desperation over their living conditions. From Paris, Khaled Sid Mohand reports.
The report released by the Council of Europe's Human Rights Commissioner Alvaro Gil Robles found gross overpopulation, rapes, rat-infested cells, Europe's highest suicide rate among prisoners, and children jailed with adults. Gil Robles wasn't planning to put France into the list of the countries to be inspected, but he changed his mind after the French human rights organizations alerted him to the conditions there. As shocking as the report is, according to Paris lawyer Véronique Massy, it describes conditions that have already been revealed to the French.
For about 10 years, we have had recurrent reports about the state of our jails, saying that they are unworthy of the nation of human rights. There have been several well-known people who have been jailed and have published books in which they denounce the conditions of detention, and still nothing. And now this last report reminds us that nothing has changed in 10 years. Even long-term prisoners are telling me, "Miss, it's disgusting." They have to relieve themselves in front of each other. They can take a shower 3 times a week, and those who have some money or who know the wardens can go more often because it's survival of the fittest. But the weak are completely crushed. And everybody, including the wardens, say that prison conditions are worse than deplorable.
44-year-old Gabriel Muesca served 17 years in jail. He leads the International Observatory for Prisons. He describes the Parisian prison called La Santé, which means health, one of the unhealthiest jails described in the report. Muesca spent 4 years there.
C'est un établissement où vous avez plus de 80 nationalités différentes qui se côtoient.
It's a penitentiary with more than 80 different nationalities living together in a sort of apartheid. There's an Arab district, an African district, and a French district. And about daily life, there are many problems linked to the prison's age. Many cells are in states that are absolutely incompatible with the notion of human dignity. If you visit the showers, you see mold from the floor to the ceiling, which is the result of a lack of ventilation. And when you take a shower, you feel dirtier than before.
Most of the problems faced in the French prisons are the consequence of the overpopulation that is the result of policies implemented by the former Minister of Justice, Dominique Perben, and the hardline Interior Minister, Nicolas Sarkozy. According to the latest figures released by the Ministry of Justice, there are 61,000 prisoners inhabiting 48,000 cells. 42-year-old Patrick Marest is a member of the CIMAD, an association that provides help and judicial assistance to the prisoners.
The United States is the perfect example to avoid, both in the fields of the judiciary and the prison policy. For the past 2 years, France has copied various aspects of the American judiciary system, increasing the number of crimes and infractions that can put you in jail, a lengthening of sentences, a lack of legislation on the rights of prisoners. Of course, we must stay away from this model and adopt the Council of Europe's recommendation.
The Council of Europe has 50 recommendations to improve France's record. They include faster and more effective access to legal assistance for detainees, separating convicts and people awaiting trial, and shortening the maximum allowed 45 days solitary confinement. And why, after so many reports, inspections, and recommendations for change, are prison conditions getting worse? Again, Gabriel Muesca.
For political reasons, because, of course, taking care of the prisons doesn't provide any votes. Taking care of the Republic's bad kids is not a worthy effort. The inmate doesn't vote, neither do most of their families. They are poor. They are of no use to those in power or to their economically powerful friends. And of course, there are a lot of foreigners.
The French Social and Economic Council will issue a new report on Thursday. But French prisoners may have to wait a long time before there's any real change in their conditions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Khaled Sidmohand in Paris.
Acting Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert declared Israel's intention to keep six of the largest West Bank settlement blocks and retain all of Jerusalem as a step toward setting Israel's permanent border. The move comes as unilateral separation procedures take place, which impose the restriction of freedom on movement against Palestinians in the West Bank. FSRN's Minar Jabrin has more.
The Israeli army started last week to implement a military order that bars Palestinians with permits from entering Israel via roads designated only for Israelis. The order not only bars Palestinian residents from crossing these checkpoints, but also forbids Israelis from transporting Palestinian residents. Palestinians and all non-Israelis must cross through one of the 11 crossing points designated by a list signed by an Israeli military official on January 3rd. The measure went into effect during the first week of this month. Mohammed, a Palestinian driver who used to cross through the non-Israeli checkpoints between Palestinian southern West Bank cities of Bethlehem and Hebron, says that such harsh restrictions are not new and have already been imposed on the checkpoints.
The situation did not change, even when the late President Yasser Arafat was in power. Now Hamas is in power, and nothing will change as well. Because of the checkpoints, employees and workers need 3 extra hours to get to their work, even if it's supposed to be a half an hour trip. Even children learn to live at the checkpoints. They know that if they want to be to school on time, they'll have to leave home 2 hours early.
The Israeli Army Seamline Administration has posted signs at all checkpoints leading into Israel, warning that non-Israelis cannot use these checkpoints. The Seamline is the area between the Green Line and the Separation Wall. The order signed on December 15th authorizes the Civil Administration Office, which belongs to the Israeli Army, to determine which crossings could be used by non-Israelis and also to determine the arrangements that will apply at these checkpoints. 8 of the 11 crossings are not on the Green Line, the border between Israel and the West Bank, drawn in 1967. These crossings do not lead to Israel. They monitor travelers within the occupied West Bank or inside the Palestinian areas, which were annexed to Israel in 1967. The Israeli government approved the already applied restrictions on Sunday. Dr. Jad Ishaq, director of Applied Research Institute Jerusalem, says these procedures that will draw the final borders of Israel amount to a geographical apartheid.
This is what I call the Israeli geographic apartheid system, which they have legalized through security pretext. This is going to be the final borders. They are being now drawn by a series of steps which they are applying through either these gates or these corridors. And it's not a secret, because Ehud Olmert made that clear, that the next Israeli elections will determine the border of Israel.
These restrictions will divide the Palestinian territories into non-contiguous areas and will likely diminish the Palestinian quest for statehood. Free Speech Ready News, Manar Jibrin, Bethlehem.
New Jersey has become the second state in the nation to institute criminal penalties for broadcasting a radio signal without a license or aiding and abetting those broadcasts. While pirate radio operators have no voice in the debate and media monopolies push the bills, Florida legislators passed a similar law in 2004. But putting enforcement in the hands of local authorities may lead to disputes between the states. And as Andrew Stelzer reports from Tampa, the laws themselves may do nothing to stem the tide of pirate radio stations.
On July 1, 2004, Florida made it a third-degree felony to broadcast without a license, punishable by up to 5 years in prison and a $5,000 fine. Almost a year later, Bob Noxious, who had appeared in newspapers as a pirate radio operator and advocate, was broadcasting a variety of programs, including punk, metal, and hip-hop on 99.9 FM in St. Petersburg, when he came home one day.
I was tipped off by my neighbors, fortunately, who said, "Hey, Bob, there's people in black suits here with sunglasses and black government cars asking questions about you. What's going on?" At that point, that's when it was over.
A few days later, FCC agents came and confronted Noxious at his job, armed with pictures.
In the picture, there was my equipment, and they had surveillance pictures of the outside of my apartment with the windows, and they showed how they lined up to the windows inside the apartment. They showed my coaxial cable going out the window, and you could see where it went up the antenna outside. They pretty much had me nailed. They said that I was breaking the law. I committed a third-degree felony, was punishable by up to a year in prison, $11,000 fine.
Noxious says the FCC agents also presented information about his personal life, including his kids and what schools they went to. He asked for a lawyer who was offered a deal by the FCC that if Noxious gave up his equipment, they'd drop the charges. Noxious's lawyer counteroffered, and since then he has not heard back from the FCC. Florida has gotten a reputation as a hotbed of pirate radio. Philip Roberts, the president of the New Jersey Broadcasters Association, lobbied for that state's law, which has penalties of up to 18 months in jail and $10,000 in fines. He believes jail time is the only deterrent that will keep pirates from setting back up again.
The FCC, in their anti-piracy efforts, doesn't have direct enforcement power. It has to depend on the state's attorney to get the enforcement done, and that sometimes can take months and sometimes years. And meanwhile, audiences are being deprived of their favorite radio station because a pirate is causing interference.
Despite the fact that pirate radio is not as big a problem in New Jersey as in Florida, Robert says there was virtually unanimous support of the law.
No opposition at all. Pirates can very well go before the legislature and explain why they're doing something illegal.
Robert says unlicensed signals can interfere with emergency or amber alerts, but Alan Pitts with the American Radio Relay League, an amateurs association based in Connecticut, says giving enforcement powers to local law enforcement agencies is inappropriate.
The ARRL would have concern if any state starts deciding to start making their own laws and, in a sense, preempting the federal government on an area that is reserved only for the federal government.
Pitts believes that lax enforcement by the FCC has led to an increase in the number of pirate stations, causing states to take matters into their own hands. But Noxious, like many unlicensed broadcasters, chose to go on air because he was frustrated by the lack of choices on the corporate-dominated radio dial and thinks that harsher legislation is simply a way for the increasingly fewer number of media conglomerates to monopolize the airwaves.
Well, I don't listen to the corporate radio stations anymore. There's nothing good to listen to unless you like the same 20 songs that they play over and over and over and over and over and over again. The companies that own all the stations, they don't want this little guy coming in and taking their listeners away. Even though I may only have a few of their listeners, they want every single one of them.
There have been no prosecutions under the New Jersey law so far. In Florida, one man pleaded guilty to a lesser misdemeanor charge after he was caught renting out office and tower space to people who ran two Haitian FM pirate stations from the premises. He had to pay almost $3,000 in fines. For FSRN, from WMNF Radio in Tampa, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.